This is Polling Matters. My name is Kieran Pedley. The election is just 48 hours away. I repeat, the election is just 48 hours away. And we can all be forgiven for feeling a bit nervous. For the first time in a generation, the country heads for an election where we really have no idea what to expect. Who will be the biggest party? How will smaller parties actually do on the day? What sort of government will we get? And of course, what about the poor pollsters? Today I'm joined by Rob Ford, who is a senior lecturer in politics at the University of Manchester, and of course, among other things, the co-author of the award-winning book Revolt on the Right. Welcome to Polling Matters, Rob.
Hi, pleased to be here.
So Rob, first of all, one of the questions that I ask all the guests during the election campaign is about what they've made of the campaign, perhaps if there's anything that surprised them. I mean, what do you think of the campaign so far?
It's been very interesting how much of a stalemate it's been, really. There hasn't really been very much movement in the overall polling numbers. I guess in terms of surprises, I've been a little bit surprised how much Ed Miliband's numbers improved. I think we all expected them to improve a little because expectations were so low. It was quite easy for him to beat them. And just from my own sort of specialist perspective, having done a lot of work on UKIP, I've been surprised, firstly, that they haven't had the level of prominence I was expecting them to have in the campaign. I think they've been kind of eclipsed by the SNP. At some point in the past few months, I believe the Westminster Village consensus has shifted to, yes, an earthquake really is happening in Scotland and we need to now try and understand what it is. And as a result, Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP have been rather dominating coverage that isn't allocated to the governing parties in England, which has pushed UKIP to the margins a bit. And also, one of the big innovations of this campaign cycle has been all the constituency polling that we're getting, and something that has very much surprised me with the constituency polling is how much the UKIP vote has been getting squeezed. It's been getting squeezed in Conservative Labour marginals, which we might expect to some degree, but also getting squeezed in seats that they would be hoping to do well in, like Dudley South, like Great Grimsby, Cannock Chase. Big drops in UKIP support, whereas we would be expecting possibly in those kind of seats that the good UKIP campaign would be gaining ground at this stage.
I mean, let's talk about UKIP. Obviously, as we all know, you've done a lot of very good work looking at them. If you were sitting hypothetically one of the campaign directors maybe at UKIP HQ, how happy do you think they would be with the campaign so far? You've mentioned they seem to be being squeezed. Do you think things are going as they would have expected?
No, I really don't. I mean, if we rewind back a year, at this point a year ago, UKIP were about to secure their first ever national election victory in the European Parliament elections, big sweeping victories in local elections and stuff like that. If you were to say to them a year from now, most predictions will have you winning 2 to 3 seats and Nigel Farage may well not make it into Westminster, I don't think they would have regarded that as a good outcome. So they do seem to have had a poor campaign in terms of, and this has always been the biggest problem for UKIP, how do you turn, under our first-past-the-post system, a 15% share of the vote into seat victories? 15%, even if you're quite concentrated in some parts of the East Coast, you get up to 25%. That's not enough. Mm. You need 35%, really, even 40% to have a chance of winning seats consistently. And my own view, and I'm going to be very interested to sort of dissect the data when we get past the election, my own view is that they've made a mistake in perhaps pushing too much to secure their kind of core vote. So they've run very, very hard on immigration. There have been a lot of contentious statements on things like migrants with HIV and so on. And really, that vote was in the bag for them. They didn't need to push very hard to get that vote. It was already there. Whereas what they needed to do, I think, was to win over sort of more moderate, more undecided voters who perhaps agreed with UKIP on many issues but regarded them as potentially irresponsible, potentially extreme. And when we look at the party image data, we see that the proportion of voters who perceive UKIP as irresponsible, as extreme, as lacking a good leadership team has gone up in the past 6 months, which is precisely the opposite of what they needed to achieve. They needed to convince people that they were a pragmatic, moderate, sensible party, and they've not. They've done the opposite.
So do you think that maybe they could have focused on some of that sort of economic populism message that's out there? Because one of the striking things to me is that when you look at UKIPers, they tend to be quite negative about the future of the economy, don't they?
Yeah.
And actually, some of the rhetoric that comes out of them feels quite similar to almost an economically leftist sort of argument. So maybe they could have focused more on that and less on the immigration side, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think what perhaps the campaign has exposed is something of a fault line between UKIP's voters and its activists. So many of its activists tend to be traditional Thatcherite free marketeers, whereas a lot of their voters tend to be, as you've noted, very economically pessimistic, tend to be quite interventionist, quite in favour of redistribution, particularly sort of state regulation of the economy and so on. And they did start making some tentative steps in that direction, but it hasn't been a major theme of their campaign, I suspect because it doesn't enthuse the activists, and some of the major backers of UKIP don't like it either. And I think that may have been a mistake, because that could have possibly been a 5-10% chunk of the vote in some of these quite economically depressed places that they could have made a better pitch for with a message more focused on those economic issues. But instead, it's just been double down on the immigration issue, double down on the EU, and that's not really winning them any new voters.
Mm. I mean, one of the sort of perhaps red herrings out there is this discussion of the national vote share, and you know, I think some pollsters, particularly online pollsters, tend to have UKIP that fair bit above some of the telephone pollsters. But then, as you say, I guess, in reality, whether that's 17% or 13%, 14%, or you know, it's odd that some dumb journalists might say in the single digits, that maybe doesn't tell us what they're going to do in their key seats that they're targeting. I mean, what's your perception of their situation in the key seats? They've obviously got Thanet South, they've got Clacton, Rochester and Strood, maybe Thurrock, people are saying. I mean, where do you get the sense of how effective their targeting is being?
It seems to have been rather poor, and I'm not sure that it's the issue is the targeting. It seems to be more with the execution. So Thanet South is obviously their number one target because Farage has put his career on the line there, and we've had a number of constituency polls in Thanet South. I think it's the most polled seat, in fact. Mm-hmm. And aside from one. Well, there's been two Servation polls that have given UKIP a clear lead, but we know from national polling that Servation tend to have a pro-UKIP house effect of about 4 to 5 points. If you allow for that, then it isn't very clear lead at all. The other polls have all basically had it as a three-way tie. Now, if you're the leader of a party that's polling 18% nationally, and your seat is the epicentre of the local campaigning, and you can't establish a clear lead, you have failed in your campaign, in my view. They would much rather have been in a situation where Thanet South was wrapped up with a bow on top, and they can focus resources elsewhere. Instead, they're still having to pull resources into Thanet to try and secure that seat. So that seat has not gone very well. By contrast, just up the Thames estuary in Thurrock, we've seen three polls showing Tim Aker in a very good position. And I think this tells us something interesting about the longer-term challenge for UKIP. Tim Aker has been fighting local elections in Thurrock since 2004. He grew up in Thurrock. He basically knows the terrain incredibly well, 10 years of working there, and he's running against a Labour candidate who's an outsider, former Ed Miliband advisor. Mm-hmm. So therefore, he's in a position both to campaign very effectively because he knows the local terrain, but also to paint his opponent as not Thurrock. And that seems to be working much more effectively. Clacton is wrapped up. The contrast between Clacton and Thurrock is going to, and Thanet rather, is going to be a very interesting one to look at post-election, because in Clacton, we're not even polling it. Nobody's polling it. It seems obvious that Douglas Carswell is going to win a massive victory, and he seems to be an extremely effective local campaigner, a very hard-working local MP as well. But then in these other seats that are sort of in the frame for them, Rochester and Strood looks rather weak. In terms of its demographics, we always thought that was more of a reach for UKIP than, say, Clacton or Thurrock. That seems to be sort of playing out now. It seems that the kind of anti-establishment dynamics of the by-election last year maybe aren't going to apply so strongly this time. The Conservatives seem quite confident of getting it back. But then in some of these other seats, away from the sort of Thames estuary zone that seems to be the epicentre of their campaign activity in places like Grimsby, Yarmouth, along the north east coast, in Dudley and Cannock in the Midlands, they're not doing well at all. And I mean, the biggest shock I've had in terms of a constituency poll was the one from Great Grimsby. I mean, we discussed Great Grimsby as demographically and in many ways politically ideal seat.
Potentially a wild card on the night that might go purple, it doesn't look like it, does it?
Yeah, it's one I'm certainly going to be watching. You've got an open seat, a long-term Labour incumbent retiring. Labour have basically been decimated in local elections over the past 10 years. It's a depressed former fishing industrial city, loads and loads of the disaffected left-behind voters that we find UKIP's pull is strongest with, and the Conservative candidate who nearly beat Austin Mitchell in 2010, the retiring MP, is standing for UKIP. Mm. It seems like the sort of perfect storm for them, yeah. But it's not happening. They're 17 points behind in Lord Ashcroft's poll with just 3 weeks to go, only 1 point ahead of the Conservative. That stunned me, that result. I thought they would be, at the very least, within a few points of the Labour candidate.
Just one poll, of course. Right.
Of course, it could end up being wrong, could end up being an outlier. It's possible that UKIP voters, I mean, all constituency polling is telephone polling. We know that they do worse than telephone polling.
Yeah.
There could be a shy UKIPer effect. But that will be the seat to watch to see whether or not they're going to have a good or a bad night. Because in many respects, it should be an ideal seat for them. Polling suggests not so good. If they do better than that polling, then I think maybe they'll nick a few others as well.
Let's look at how they might do then on Thursday. Just looking at social media, some of the questions that come through. Tom Lubbock asks about the kind of the UKIPers that are drifting away and who's left. And there is this perception, as you mentioned earlier, of UKIP being squeezed, although again at the national level it's perhaps more ambiguous. Do you have any sense of who you think is drifting away from UKIP and who is remaining, or do you think it's just general churn?
At the national level, there doesn't seem to be any sustained evidence of a decline. There was a bit of a decline at the turn of the year, which seems to be that they hit a peak after the by-election wins that was probably unsustainably high for them. I mean, they had about a month.
25, I think, with Salvation.
In some polls, yeah. They were certainly, in our polling averages, we had them getting up to about 18%. They've fallen back about 2 or 3 points on that. But that was probably unsustainably high as the product of a big wave of positive media attention and stuff like that. Normality resumed. But in the past sort of month or so of the short campaign, they've been pretty flat at about sort of 14, 15%. They've probably come down a bit from there on the day, I think. Who have they lost? Well, I've not sort of looked at it in detail, but I think it's been pretty much a representative mix of who they had already. I mean, I think that they haven't lost their sort of most depressed, pessimistic, nationalistic voters. So maybe people are a little bit moderate on those kinds of things. It seems to be more a case of who are they losing locally rather than who are they losing nationally. And again, it does seem to be a case of rather than any particular demographic or any particular message cutting through and winning UKIPers back, it's simply that those candidates who are doing the hard work of actually reappealing to these voters, persuading them, talking to them, are out-competing UKIP in that respect and thereby winning UKIP voters back. UKIP just don't seem to have the kind of local organisations they need to hold on to these voters. They're getting outgunned.
I mean, not putting you on the spot in terms of a formal prediction, but what does your gut say in terms of how many seats they might end up with? I mean, there's a big sort of in amongst the political betting community, this is obviously something of massive interest. You know, not just will Farage win, but how many seats are they going to get? And you know, some people think, oh, Douglas Carswell might end up as a leader of one in the House of Commons, and others, you know, are more bullish. I mean, where's your sense of which way it's going to go? Maybe.
Well, to steal a phrase that was used about the Liberals back in the 1950s, I think there's a very good chance that UKIP end up being able to fit all their MPs into the back of a black cab. Carswell is almost a certainty, I think. Thurrock, I would have to say that they're favourites, but it's still tight. I know that the Labour campaign in Thurrock believe that they are beginning to turn the ship around there. But let's give them a better than evens chance there. You'd have to say Farage is marginal favourite in Thanet South as well. So they're probably going to get at least one out of those two. So that's 2 to 3. And then I would say there's probably about another half a dozen, maybe 10 seats where they are in with a shout.
Competitive, maybe.
Competitive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because, you know, it's volatile, they're new, it's hard to poll. Just as a sort of a gambler and probabilist myself, I would say I want to give them probably one in those 10. If we say they have a 10% chance on average across those 10, I wouldn't want to say which one it would be. I think it's very hard to know. So that would give me an estimate of, say, 3 to 4 would be my... I mean, and that's a lot lower than I would have given you if we'd have had this interview in December.
6 months ago or something,
So I would say 3 to 4 at the moment. If they get to 5 or more, I think it'll be a very positive night for them. They'll be very happy with that.
I mean, looking again at some of the questions from social media from Chairman Moe, I'm sure that's not your real name. I'm not entirely sure who that is, but again, I'm just going to read out your names on dear Twitter people as you have them on social media. Where stands UKIP's 2020 strategy after a seemingly angry right core vote general election campaign that may garner 2 seats? So he's sticking his neck out there. And Leo Barassi, fellow podcaster, talks about what do UKIP do after the election, either if Farage is or isn't elected. So a couple of questions there coming through about, I guess, what do UKIP do next? Because I guess with an election campaign, it's very easy to get obsessed by Thursday. Mm, there will be a world after Thursday. I mean, what's your perception of where they go next? Presumably, Nigel Farage is integral to what happens next.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Leo puts it well by saying, you know, even Farage is and isn't elected, because it's two very different worlds for them in those situations. I mean, I think the first immediate task after the election will be managing the disappointment amongst the activist base. Activists from all political parties tend to be rather unrealistic types. I think I saw somebody tweeting that they thought the Lib Dems could win Gordon against Alex Salmond. Okay. I don't think that's very likely. UKIP activists seem to have this sort of delusional psychology in a particularly intense form, perhaps because they're a new party. A lot of these people who are joining them are new to politics.
There's a siege mentality as well, isn't there?
And there's a siege mentality too, but you'll regularly get UKIPers confidently predicting that they'll hold the balance of power, that they'll have 30 seats, 50 seats, 100 seats, that they'll win places like Falkirk or Colchester or Buckingham, places where they have no hope at all of winning. So there's going to be a crashing disappointment to come for a lot of these people when it turns out that UKIP has a very small parliamentary delegation and essentially no influence in most post-election scenarios. So they have to try and figure out how to manage that disappointment. Mm. And probably the way to do it will be to refocus energy on the next waves of elections. UKIP internally have already been framing this as the 2020 strategy. Get lots of second places this time and then plough our energies into those places where we're now the kind of official opposition locally and try and use that as a building block towards wins in 2020. It's very much the Liberal Democrats model from the 1990s when they sort of rebuilt from the crashing disappointment of the SDP's failure. So if they can manage that and keep their activists and their funders on board with that, then I think that has a lot of potential as a strategy, because we are going to have a relatively weak, relatively divided government, possibly with the Scots playing a powerful role, which will inflame English nationalism, which is an important motivator of UKIP support. And within a year, you'll have very wide-ranging local elections, including in many of our biggest cities and a lot of depressed towns where UKIP can do well, and in the Welsh Assembly, where there are very large numbers of voters in the Welsh Valleys who fit the UKIP demographic, and UKIP have been steadily marching upwards in the polls in Wales, something that people haven't picked up on. So there is a lot of potential for them to turn the ship around a little bit in 2016 if they can keep everybody on board and avoid an internal split in 2015. And it's important to remember UKIP have form on this. They have split nearly split on 3 occasions following general elections in their 20-year history. And if Farage is defeated, that likelihood goes up a lot, because there is no heir apparent. And there are probably half a dozen or more candidates amongst the sort of senior UKIP leadership who would regard themselves as potential leaders, who would probably throw their hats into the ring. So that could become quite a polarising and bloody leadership battle. So the risk being, of course, that the loser doesn't accept defeat and marches off with a bunch of activists to found their own party, like Robert Kilroy Silk did with Veritas. That would be a disaster for them. So there's a lot of risks. The risks are higher if Farage isn't there. And the key task will be convincing people that this result is a setback but not a disaster.
And I mean, presumably, feeding on from this idea of a potential split, there is a difficult strategy
or a strategic line to traverse vis-a-vis the Conservatives, because UKIP have been at pains, haven't they, to sort of say we're not just Tory light, we're actually, you know, we're taking votes from Labour as well as the Conservatives. But then it feels like in the last couple of days, the Conservatives at least seem to think that, no, actually, come home, you know, you're kind of actually our votes to win back. And then likewise, when you look at the, in theory, the objective of an EU referendum is the all-encompassing objective. Presumably, you know, some form of pact in the, locally in the future with the Conservatives would be the best way of achieving that, to create a sort of majority in the House of Commons that actually wants an EU referendum. I mean, how do you see them traversing that, or does it really come down to who's in government in a few days' time?
I think any kind of electoral pact would be very dangerous for them, because part of their appeal is this sort of classic radical right thing of
we're not like the others.
The establishment, yeah. We're not like the others. And as soon as you start doing any kind of deals with people like Rees-Mogg or Bill Cash or anything like that, that really undermines your claim to be apart from and different to the establishment. So I don't think that we'll see that. In terms of their behaviour in Parliament, it does get rather interesting. I mean, what do UKIP do if there is a referendum and it's lost? You know, the country votes no to leaving the EU, let's say. Then how do they manage that? The SNP have managed to sort of ride that to great success.
That would be ideal from a UKIP perspective, obviously. Yeah,
but... Yeah. The SNP managed to use the referendum campaign to increase support for independence in Scotland, whereas so far there's what Cinder Cadwallon nicely calls the UKIP paradox, which is the more the cause of independence from Europe becomes associated with UKIP, the lower the support for it seems to go, because voters then start to think of it as an extreme position, a risky position, and particularly sections of the electorate that are very ideologically opposed to UKIP for other reasons, like young voters, ethnic minorities, social liberals and so on, they become more pro-EU because they think, well, anything that Nigel Farage is in favour of, I don't want to be
opposed.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, entertainingly, we've just been had to move due to a fire alarm. So those listening, if this sounds slightly different, that's why. Let's carry on. We've got about sort of 10 minutes left. There's been a lot of talk, Rob, about legitimacy of government. If I was being unkind, that sounds a little bit like the Conservatives preparing the ground for maybe being the biggest party and not being able to form a government. Some would even say that might even being the biggest party might be optimistic, but I guess we will see soon enough. If we take as a given that, obviously, constitutionally, it's perfectly legitimate for the second biggest party to form a government, what do we think about public opinion? Because, I mean, one of the things we in politics need to continuously remind ourselves is that actually the public don't pay attention to the sort of constitutional niceties of how we're governed or the people involved as much as we do. So there does seem to be some evidence that Labour finishing second, particularly with the support of the Scottish Nationalists, might not go down particularly well. I'd like to get your thoughts on that whole theme.
Well, I agree with you that legitimacy is not going to decide who gets into number 10. We know what the equation is on that, and it's very simple. It's who can command the confidence of the House of Commons. And if the Conservatives are 5 seats ahead in the Commons, but Labour plus the SNP plus the various other small parties committed to voting down any Conservative Queen's speech gets to more than 3-2-3, they form a government. So I suspect it's not just about the Conservatives trying to pave the way for a potential continuation in some sort of minority, but also providing them with a powerful argument to use to undermine a Labour government from a position of opposition. And I think that the critical thing in this could actually prove to be, as you say, the role of the SNP. I don't think most voters pay much attention to how a government got there once they get there. The Liberal Democrats' great hope for decades has been that if first past the post delivers results that are not in proportion to the votes that were cast, that people will notice this and regard it as illegitimate. It doesn't really seem to happen. Once somebody's in number 10 and doing the job of governing, the public tends to go back to thinking about other things and leaves them to get on with it. The problem, I think, that comes is if you have a situation where you have a relatively weak and unstable government, which the current polling suggests we may well have, and that government is in a position to be defeated by rebellions from a party that's pretty much defined by its constitutional beliefs and its belief in sort of bringing Scotland out of the Union. Because English voters tend not to like that, the idea that the Scottish nationalists in that situation would be playing a large role in deciding what happens in England. And I think it's no accident that the level of concern about the SNP is much higher than the level of concern about the Liberal Democrats. So on a par with the level of concern about UKIP, but UKIP aren't likely to play a role.
Which is understandable, but still interesting, because actually the Liberal Democrats are not particularly popular. You know, in some cases polling in single digits, aren't they? So
Yeah, it is interesting because it suggests, well, firstly it may reflect the fact that the Liberal Democrats are regarded as more ideologically moderate, but it also seems to reflect a general acceptance that perhaps as a result of 5 years in coalition, that the Liberal Democrats can play a useful and legitimate and valuable role. I think what more English voters are aware of now than were a few years ago, and it'll be an interesting question whether or not that awareness continues, is that our constitutional settlement post-devolution is asymmetric. So Scottish MPs can vote on various domestic English legislative issues that don't have any impact on how things play out in Scotland. This was already true in the last Labour government. Mm. So, for example, the tuition fee increased to £3,000, passed with Scottish votes, didn't apply to Scotland, though. It wouldn't have passed without those Scottish votes. However, all those votes were within one party, and I think, therefore, the public didn't really necessarily pick up on this issue, the so-called West Lothian issue. Whereas if the votes that pass legislation have to come from the SNP, I think that the West Lothian issue will be thrown into sharp relief. And I think that what the Conservatives are preparing the ground for, what we've already seen quite a lot of evidence for in this current short campaign, is an argument that goes, it is not legitimate for a government reliant on Scottish votes to govern England. So they're going to look to use nationalism as a kind of crowbar to prise apart the legitimacy of the government. I think it's a very dangerous move in many respects, because it's likely to further put into doubt the status of the union. It's hard to imagine Scots voters reacting very favourably to this argument that whereas Liberal Democrats elected from Cornwall are perfectly legitimate as part of the government, Scots elected from Glasgow are not. It's called the United Kingdom of England, Scotland and Wales. They all have equal status as MPs. So it will further inflame Scottish opinion potentially against the union, while also looking to inflame English opinion against the union too. So I think that's probably the direction of travel they're going with the legitimacy argument, rather than making a more abstract sort of constitutional point.
And of course, I mean, we shouldn't assume that David Cameron is toast. It's entirely possible that maybe, you know, the polls are slightly understating the Conservative votes, and perhaps there's an incumbency effect, you know, with 2020 Conservative MPs that keep him in. But let's hypothetically carry that thought on. If there is a Labour minority government backed by the SNP, presumably there's two things that we can be reasonably sure of. One is that in the Conservative leadership campaign, this is going to be an issue, and they're going to be playing towards the Conservative base on it, or at least certain candidates will be. And also, presumably the SNP have an interest in being pretty reasonable for the first year in government. I'm thinking of the Holyrood elections next year. They don't want to be bringing any government down between now and those elections, do they? So perhaps we can be reasonably sure that the Conservatives might be doing the running here, or am I trusting the SNP a bit too much?
No, I think that this is a very good point, and I think this is the risk of the way the Conservatives have cast the choice, that they've kind of made this argument that the SNP will make merry hell when given this position of influence. And if on the other hand, it turns out that the SNP behave in a kind of boringly responsible fashion, it will probably undercut that argument rather strongly. And I think there's two reasons to think that the SNP will behave that way. The first is, as you note, for the SNP, the most important elections are actually a year away. They're the Scottish Parliament elections. Because if they are to bring the issue of independence back onto the agenda, the first step for them is to achieve a second majority at Holyrood, which they can then take as an electoral mandate from the Scottish people. Indeed, it would be the third electoral mandate that they'd successfully won to basically pursue this agenda further. And of course, if more powers are devolved to the Scottish Parliament, it's quite likely that there's also substantive political reasons for wanting that position. But secondly, nearly all of the SNP MPs elected to Parliament this time will be political novices, Westminster novices. They won't have had any particular experience in national government. They've never been in the House of Commons. Many of them will not even know each other, because they'll be young activists who've worked for the SNP.
Some people wouldn't expect to win, to be be honest, didn't they?
Exactly. Yeah, many, including people who were selected at a time when the SNP thought there was no chance of them winning. And such a group of people, one shouldn't make confident predictions about how such a group of people will behave, because it's a big unknown. But it seems likely that they'll take a degree of direction from the people they look up to, in particular Alex Salmond, who's quite a hero for them, and that therefore if he sort of whips them to be responsible, say, well, we shouldn't vote on this issue, it's a bit too England specific, or we should throw our weight in behind Labour on this issue to help them, that they'll do that. And so I suspect that their behaviour will be less rowdy, less chaotic, less attention-seeking than people assume it will be, and actually more like responsible. I mean, in many respects, they may be more reliable votes for much of the Labour government's programme than some of the Labour backbenchers.
Well, this is it, isn't it? I mean, one of the overlooked things, I think, on both sides, when I say both sides, the Conservatives and Labour, is that actually we're talking about coalitions or confidence of supply or just minority informal relationships, but actually it's the Peter Bones or the Diane Abbotts or the Jeremy Corbyns or whoever it might be that actually are the ones that, you know, I mean, took a look at Labour again, they could be the biggest problem for Ed Miliband, couldn't they?
Well, absolutely.
Without, again, getting ahead of ourselves, putting him in number 10 when he moved.
Well, whoever you put in number 10, this is a relevant question, because the question everyone's focused on right now, with 2 days to go until the election, is who will get to 323 votes and thereby get into the Commons. I say 323 because the Sinn Féin MPs don't take their seats. But the relevant question for where we go after mid-May is, well, how do we govern with what we've now put together? And that's a very different and altogether more difficult question. So if you get a Labour-led coalition of the sort of broad left with a majority of 10, then take the 10 most rebellious Labour MPs and imagine that, you know, you have to persuade them on everything. Mm-hmm. If you get a Conservative-led coalition or grouping of them, the Lib Dems and the DUP, first of all, imagine trying to get the Lib Dems and the DUP to agree on social issues.
Well, it's marching
fun.
Season in Northern Ireland, it's not too far away, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's another overlooked thing, you know. Someone has family over there. There's a good couple of days of rioting every summer, and you know, some of these things around parade commissions, and it's, you know, these things are devolved. But at the same time, it's reasonable to think that they might become quite important in Westminster.
Yeah, firstly, because the sight of unionists with veto power at Westminster will inflame nationalist sentiment, quite possibly. And secondly, what's been happening in Scotland and the way that the Conservatives have reacted to it has really, it seems, worried an awful lot of unionists. I mean, they are called unionists for a reason, and they fear that an unravelling of the union with Scotland will have knock-on implications for the situation in Ireland. So any government that's reliant on unionist support, I would imagine that the DUP would be potentially a more volatile partner than, for example, the SNP. But on top of that, you've got the issue of, again, take the 10, 15 most rebellious Conservative backbenchers from the last Parliament. Imagine saying to them, I'm sorry, we have to rely on 20 Liberal Democrat votes to get anything done, so you're just going to have to shut up on various issues that you care about a lot. I don't think that's necessarily going to be a very easy conversation to have. So on either side, once we get to a situation of somebody being installed in Downing Street, you then get onto the much harder problem of you're going to have to muster votes on a day-by-day, week-by-week basis from people who don't exactly take direction very easily. Mm. And that seems to be true almost regardless of who wins, because unless the polls are completely wrong, whoever wins will do so very narrowly.
Mm. And I guess in conclusion, a couple of minutes left, that sort of neatly brings us onto this potential for a second election, either this year or in the not-too-distant future. We all know about the Fixed Term Parliament Act. Are we giving that too much respect, though? If there is chaos you know, after Thursday, is there more chance of another election either this year or quite soon than we think?
I think that there are ways in which a second election could happen next year, but I do think that we are in unknown territory in terms of how the parties will behave in response to the Fixed Term Parliaments Act. It has become a lot harder to bring a government down and a lot harder to bring to begin a new election. And the evidence from other countries where there have been longer strings of close elections is that people find a way of governing, find a way of managing things through to the next election. So Canada has many years of minority government, for example. So it's quite possible that we might get several changes of, say, Prime Minister, perhaps even changes in the party that occupies the office of Prime Minister, without getting an election. partly because of the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, but the other reason, of course, is that it may not be in the interests of the parties who are in a position to bring a government down to have an election, either because they don't have the money to finance it, or in the case of some of the minor parties, because they have other elections that they want to focus on. The SNP will want to focus on the Scottish Parliament election, Plaid will probably want to focus on the Welsh Assembly election, parties in Northern Ireland will want to focus on the Northern Ireland Assembly election. So many of the minor parties who have a big role to play here won't necessarily want another UK general election. Labour probably won't want one either because they are really short on money. The Liberal Democrats even more so. So the issue that you'll have is that maybe a lot of people will want to bring a government down, but nobody will want to have to go through the process of having an election.
That was Polling Matters. A big thanks again to my guest, Rob Ford. The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under Creative Commons. And thanks very much for listening. In 2 days' time, we have the general election, so let's stay tuned for more episodes of Polling Matters then, but also in the future as we dissect what happened. Thanks for listening.